Hello and welcome to The Winning Agenda. Tonight our panellists include a runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey Brian, how are we doing?
Two-time store champion and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor Wilfie Horrig.
Hey everyone, what's up?
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor Jesse Marshall.
Sometimes a single stone is enough.
More than often, it is not. And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. We're going to get stuck right into the meat of it tonight with a deck tech on a noise mid-range list from Mr. Jesse Marshall. So, Jesse, what have you got for us?
Yeah, I've been playing around with noise probably for better part of a year now, trying to get it to a point where I'm feeling comfortable with the resources. And one of the problems that I've always found is that you, as an Anarch, you rarely have an advantage in terms of accumulating cards or credits. You don't really have a way of accumulating either of those resources particularly efficiently. In faction, there are some neutral cards that allow you to do it well, like Sure Gamble, but you don't have a critical mass of them. And what that means is that if you don't draw in your opening hand, things that give you, or in your first few draws, things that give you easy access to both cards and credits, you'll often stall out and have to slow down and spend far too many clicks just clicking for one card or for one credit in the mid game, whereas a Crim deck or a Shaper deck will often be able to do that at a much more efficient rate by that stage of the game, which puts Anarch decks too far behind oftentimes in the mid game going into the late game, and means that they rely far more on what is in many cases higher raw power level in their cards, but that leads to higher variance because you're not going to be able to play as many of them. You're not going to be reliably able to access the ones that you need at the right time. The other problem with Anarch decks has been, because you have slightly deficient card draw, you have a difficult time accessing the programs that you need to get into service when you want to, and you also don't have access to tutors. Crims have special order for icebreakers, and Shapers have self-modifying code for programs and test run. Anarchs don't really have anything. So if you're not importing one of those two cards, you're having a difficult time accessing the programs you want when you need them. What I've done with this deck is to go with what I think is the real power of Anarch and Noise, which is the mill ability on Noise. I think it's an extremely powerful ability, and I'm trying to maximize it using what has been developing for quite a long time as a strategy, which is using as many one-cost viruses as you can that are good. So you've got Data Sucker, Kaish, and Gorman Drip. A lot of people have built decks with those three at the core of it for Noise. Then you've got Imp, which is an extremely valuable card to have in the current metagame, particularly where there are a lot of assets sitting in remote servers, a lot more assets with higher trash costs and lower res costs, which is increasing the power of Imp. You've also got a lot of Wayland decks going around where you can trash those Scorched Earths out of hand. Then you've got Parasite as another virus, which is an extremely powerful and efficient way to get through ice. So around that core of viruses, I've then added in Gravedigger from Order and Chaos, which is a card that I was quite excited about when it was spoiled, because it's one of the first cards that's allowed you to build on Noise's ability and have another way of really pressing home that advantage and adding additional threat in a place where the threat was good, but in many cases it wasn't quite powerful enough to be a knockout punch. So you've also got Grimoire as the console in this deck, obviously with so many viruses, which gives you that little bit more economic benefit out of your Kaishas and your Gorman Drips, a little bit more speed out of your Parasites and your Data Suckers, a bit more reach out of your Imps. And out of Gravedigger, it gets you an initial trash off the Noise ability when you install it, a click to trash from that first virus counter you get when you install, and then you're also accumulating virus counters whenever you use a Parasite or an Imp, or whenever the Corp trashes a card, or whenever the Corp trashes an Ice to install over, or whenever you trash an asset manually. So that's usually enough situations where you can accumulate extra virus tokens from Gravedigger. But even just getting that initial mill from the install and then the extra mill from the virus counter you use, plus maybe one or two over the course of the game, is generally enough to make that a valuable enough play. So that's the virus suite at the core of it. Then I'm playing Clone Chip, which allows you to both recur whichever viruses you need at the time you particularly need them, but also allows you to fetch Medium and Nerve Agent from your heap at the time that you need them. Those cards are extremely powerful win conditions and always have been at the core of powerful Noise decks, but playing multiples of them really hampers your draws. When your draws were already difficult and drawing cards was already reasonably inefficient, having more cards that are situational and not useful at helping you accumulate resources. Essentially having too many programs in your deck makes your draws even more inefficient. So being able to play one copy of those two aggressive cards and fetch them reasonably reliably from your heap with Clone Chip is good. What Clone Chip also allows you to do is to play Inject. So that Inject helps you to get around that drawing problem because it's a very efficient draw engine. You're getting four cards for one credit. Some of them are going into your heap, and with Clone Chip, that actually becomes a benefit rather than a hindrance, particularly if you're milling away single copies of Icebreakers like Yogg or Mimic or Corroder when you need them, or if you're wanting to recur your Medium or your Nerve Agent. So at the core of the draw engine, I've got three Injects and two I've Had Worse, which doubles up as damage protection, as many people would know, but also gives you that draw ability if you need it. Then you've got Sure Gamble and Daily Cast to round out the economy, and Hades Shard to allow you to access archives if you're struggling in the late game, but you've managed to mill a lot of cards into there. And also, a lot of people still don't use their Jackson Howards until the very last minute, and you can still get them with Hades Shard using the install on one of your clicks, manual installing it for 7.
Just on that as well, I was speaking with Wilfie today, and he clarified something about the paid ability window at the beginning of the runner's turn. Wilfie, could you just touch on that for those of the listeners who aren't aware?
Yeah, so this came up in a game where I was playing my IT department deck against MaxX Eater Keyhole deck, which manually installed the Hades Shard, and then I went to my turn, and you can install Jackson, use Jackson, go to discard, so I had 8 cards in my hand, and discard 3 cards, and then after you discard, there's a paid ability window where you can use the Jackson, and because it's still during the corpse turn, the corp has the ability to act first. So you can discard cards down to 5, and then immediately use Jackson without giving the runner time to respond, even if they already have Hades Shard on the field, which is something that's important, but just only recently came up for me.
Sorry if that nerfs some of your tech there, Jesse, but go
no,
on.
No, the tech is not leaving the Hades Shard sitting on the battlefield, Brian. The tech is actually installing it and using it straight away. So, I would definitely advise people when they're using Hades Shard to keep it in hand for as long as possible, and then install and try to ambush the corp with it.
So you would advise against trying to get the free install with the archives run?
I certainly would, yes. I think the threat of Hades Shard is being able to install and use it straight away when the corpse blindsided, and if you can get into archives, if it's sitting there, then it's not as powerful. The last few cards that I just want to touch on are the Icebreakers. So I'm playing 3 Corroders, a Yogg, 2 Mimics, and a Zul Keymaster. Zul is an efficient Icebreaker that allows you to get past Lotus Field. A problem for a lot of these Anarch decks that are playing the Corroder Mimic Yogg suite is that you can get locked out, and you can get locked out quite easily by Lotus Field. Only having one Zul is not optimal, and it's definitely one of the problems that I've been having with this deck because you don't have a tutor for Icebreakers and you're relying on naturally drawing these cards with your Inject and your I've Had Worses. Sometimes your Zul just won't come, and having no other way to get through Lotus Fields is quite painful.
Is Knight a bit too slow for your game plan there?
Yeah, Knight just slows things down a little bit too much. The whole aim of this deck is to try and make the clicks a little bit more efficient, to really focus every click that you use on installing a virus, and hopefully as a corollary of that, you're milling the cards with Noise's ability, but hopefully also as a corollary of that, you're gaining credits off a Kaish or a Gorman Drip, or gaining some other kind of economic advantage in the form of Parasite, Data Sucker, Imp, etc. So yeah, if you're having to spend clicks on Knight, installing, moving it around, and spending 2 credits, it's quite an inefficient Icebreaker. Probably the next thing that I would consider adding in as a solution to Lotus Field if it becomes too much of a problem, Zul is really already a concession to that. Yogg deals with most other things more efficiently, and you're generally fast enough to be able to force your way into servers early and accumulate those data sucker counters. But another solution for Lotus Field is certainly something that I'm thinking about. At the moment, I'm not really sure where I would want to cut things from, possibly a Corroder, but that's about the only slot where I think that you could cut something without compromising either another matchup by losing something like David, or compromising the power of the economy engine from the viruses and the threat from Noise.
I just would have thought that that Knight would have been quite balanced in that kind of deck, where you do have a way to punish them for maybe trashing, for overriding their Knight of the Ice with Gravedigger, and you also have a way of kind of tricking it in when you need it at those very exact times with a Clone Chip, which is what some people have difficulty with, finding the two clicks in one turn to install it and place it out on the ice and then make the run. So, you know, it has everything going for it in the deck.
Yeah, that's true. All right, cut that whole bit. I'm replacing a Corrota with a Knight. You've all convinced me.
Sure.
Are you playing Cyberfeather, Jesse?
No. So I'm playing Grimoire as the sort of hardware base for the deck, if you like. I've considered Cyberfeather, and again, partly it's a deck space issue, and partly it's that most of the cards that I'm playing to support runs are viruses, if that makes sense. So things like Kaish and Gormandrip and Datasucker are all about supporting your runs and helping you to get in more efficiently, and they are also viruses. So I feel like those are the slots where you would fit in a Cyberfeather, but losing those cards would lose you not only the mill ability from Noise, but also the economy that they provide. In exchange, you get the economy from Cyberfeather, but I feel that the upside of the Noise mill and having the extra cheap viruses is probably more where you want to go with this deck.
It certainly is a slower option. But, you know, if most of your games are culminating in that Hades Shard access, I guess it depends on when you want to actually start running. So,
yeah, and like you say, the flexibility of the Cyberfeather credit is somewhat limited. So although it can be a useful card for making runs every turn, this deck actually doesn't need to be making runs every turn because you can be...
It can also pay for viruses.
Yeah, that's true. But the one thing that the deck will struggle with more than paying for viruses is paying for the Hades Shard, for Icebreakers, and for the Grimoire. So, I mean, because most of your viruses are replacing their own costs in the Kaish, Parasite, to an extent, Datasucker, and Gormandrip, installing the viruses is not generally such a huge economic impost. I mean, obviously, credits are fungible, so losing a credit somewhere is losing a credit everywhere. But I feel that as I was saying, if the slot that you're losing is most likely going to be something like a Kaish or a Gormandrip, to include a Cyberfeather, the flexibility of those cards and the credits they provide, in addition to the benefit you get from Noise, is probably what tips them over the edge in this particular deck.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess I've always kind of considered Cyberfeather and Grimoire very comparable effects when around that Kaish kind of Gormandrip kind of style, because they both gain you effectively one more credit. So, you know, I personally like a blend maybe of 2 and 2 or of 3 and 2. At 6 is probably too many. But yeah, you know, whichever way you want to take it, it's all good.
Well, obviously you're both insane because the only way to mitigate the true cost of those viruses is by hosting them on a Shahrazad. Moving on.
You're a madman.
Jesse, unfortunately, has had to leave us because he has to get back to his battle with Goliath. Fortunately, we have Liam Shielsey-Prasad here with the deck tech. Now, Liam, you won your second store championship a couple of weeks ago with this sort of pet next aggro deck you've been putting together. For those of you who checked out Liam's most recent article on what he calls the meta side game, he does reference it quite a bit. So hopefully we're going to get a nice in-depth deck tech on this particular strategy. So Liam, take us through it.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, winning a second store champs was very, very exciting. It was probably more exciting than the first one because I'm so tentative about these kind of things that when I was in the finals of the first one, I kind of just was the mind without a mind. I kind of just played it out and just really got into the game and didn't think too much about it. But in this second one, because there was really no costs attached to it, I kind of just really got in there and enjoyed it. So I had a lot of fun with that. And these particular decks I took in on the day were intrinsic to that fun. I took in the next aggro deck that I've been working on for the past few weeks, which kind of just struck me in the middle of the night. It kind of came together really, really quickly. Basically, the idea is to use next design, guarding the net, the HB identity, to quite consistently put 1 or 2 or 3, even 3 sometimes, pieces of ice on your centrals, or even make it even a single ice remote before the game starts. Draw up to 5 again, draw your additional card, having seen up to 9 cards in hand, and then use cards like Mushin Notion, Shipment from Sansan, and Biotic Labor to start scoring basically straight away. Because the ice is already down and you're a turn ahead of the runner, You can use cards like green level clearance and blue level clearance to keep your economy afloat whilst you just dig for cards as quickly as possible, because those blue level and green level are the most effective at seeing both cards and credits when you value them roughly equally. And yeah, that's basically it. You just kind of start scoring very, very aggressively. If they have the answers, if they have the breakers, you definitely lose. I'm playing a sneaky June bug just to try and catch some people. You know, when you do fall that far behind, you can be like, you know, Mushin Noshin, put a paper wall in front of a June bug. They run there and they cop six to the face because you are threatening 7 points or whatever. But really, the only impunity in the mid game is through that bardic labor. The deck's not playing Sansan. The deck's not playing Ash. They're not playing any of those upgrades that people usually use in mid-range strategies to force their agendas through and protect the upgrades rather than the agendas themselves. This deck only plays harder than the run ice, and the next silver ice and the next bronze ice are very particularly good for that. I've also found Guard quite effective in that regard. So,
we're seeing a bit of an uprise in Femme in the current meta, with a lot of Max lists and some Valencia lists playing Femmes. So was the Guard a meta call there, or was it something like over Roto Turret in that slot, which is less susceptible to Parasite for the same reasons?
Yeah. I had three slots initially set aside for Roto Turret, but it was too expensive. So then I culled it down to two because you just couldn't afford to draw two of those slots. And then the Rotos, exactly like you were saying there, Brian, exactly like you were saying there about Parasites. Having too many of your ice susceptible to Parasite on turn one is a massive deal breaker. So next Bronze and next Silver and Paper Wall are all quite good in this regard. But Quandary and Roto Torrent are not. And just in an Anarch heavy meta, well, they'll all have three Parasites, but not necessarily three Yogs or three Knights or three Mimics or three Corrodas. Asking them for a Parasite rather than an actual Icebreaker is much softer stuff, especially when they have the clone chips. They can bring it back, and then they can bring it back during your turn and kill a Silver with it as well. It's a really flexible card, and being able to take down a Quandary and a Silver or and a Paper Wall, so a Code Gate and a barrier without installing a breaker at all, is really powerful, especially when they can get it done by turn two, which is at the same speed that you're actually trying to kill them in. So Parasite's a big deal. So Guard is certainly in recognition of that. Yeah.
Wilfie, you had a chance to play this list in a couple of games recently in testing. You've played HB Fast Advance before, as we know your pet deck was the one Jesse chose to take to Worlds. How did it feel in comparison to the deck you're usually used to playing? Did you think that, like, oftentimes when I'm playing Fast Advance, it would be nice to have like a free turn at the beginning to ice up my centrals, because you don't really want to be putting resources and clicks into doing that early. Did you find that was sort of helpful towards your game plan?
I thought that this deck was very different, despite maybe looking similar to the HB Fast Advance deck that I'm a big proponent of. Not necessarily in a bad way, but just in a sense that they have totally different goals. The HB Fast Advance deck that I like is a mid-range deck that tries to use Adonis Campaign and the ability to gain advantage with reasonably middle-strength ice that is not that easy to break, so you can eventually start setting up a Sansan in a server, or just naturally an Engender in a server, and use Bionic Labor to score the last couple points when they have their rig set up and they can get to your servers with impunity. The next design deck, on the other hand, is really trying to rush out agendas from turn one, and this is a lot different than something which I wasn't really used to. I was kind of expecting to just sit back, develop my board, and eventually get a Sansan server going, but that's definitely, when I looked at the deck, I didn't even have Sansan, so that was definitely something which I found a bit strange, but it definitely worked well in its goal, which is to be as fast as possible and to try and end the game without worrying about your opponent's resources or trying to get to the end game or how efficient your turns are, and just trying to push out points as fast as possible.
Yeah, you certainly can't afraid of anything at all. It doesn't let you. Like, if you take a turn hesitating, if you stumble at all, and they do just have that one more turn of drawing cards, or even just that one more turn of getting the credits they need to play a breaker in their hand, that can often be the difference between a win and a loss.
I just wanted to ask a question to Shilzy. I noticed that when you wrote your wonderful article on the meta side game, which, if you haven't checked it out, you definitely should. It's a very insightful article into modern Netrunner. There was a post on a forum which asked you why, if you had such few ice in this deck, it didn't have as many as next design decks usually do, why you would play next design over engineering in the future, which is usually the default for basically any purple strategy, regardless of how fast or slow it is. And while engineering in the future isn't as good in these kind of decks because you're not planning to make the game go too long, the extra credit each turn is still beneficial in making your turns more consistent. So can you go over a little bit of your reasoning there?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I guess there are two sides to that. One side is the question, how much value do I expect to get out of playing next design? And then the other is, if I was trying to do the same thing in ETF, how would I have to change the deck to do that? And I think that if I tried to play the same deck in ETF, I would need to increase the number of ice, because with those five cards in hand at the start of the game and the one mandatory draw, to ice up my R&D, at least my HQ, and then a remote to start scoring out of, and to do that, this kind of play where you say, ice HQ, ice remote, 3-2 in the remote, you would need access to at least two ice, usually three ice in hand, every game from five cards. And, you know, if we say, how do you get the maximum efficiency out of next, well, you would say, I would want three ice in my opening hand. But that's not actually the case, because you have a mulligan, which you do in ETF as well, but you have a mulligan that's really dynamic and is also always trying to be aggressive. So in those hands where I have a paper wall and a Mushin Notion and a 5-3 and no other ice, I can just not use the ability. And I can just Mushin Notion, paper wall at the front and start scoring the 5-3. And yeah, like, there are lots of matchups in which I'm happy to do that, particularly in shaper matchups now, because Anarchs have the potential of maybe a turn one wanton destruction, and criminals obviously have the potential of a turn one account siphon. But you only really need one piece of ice to get it going, because usually just any advantage out of the gate is enough to really just cement your position as the beatdown and ask the runner to try and respond as quickly as possible as they can as well. So, you know, like, yep, three ice is fine. Honestly, you can't res all of it, so, because you're investing so much in the agendas. Resing three ice in the course of a game is often very difficult, especially in those early turns when you're scoring out rather than maybe playing by blue level or green level in the first turns. It's not like the ETF strategies, the mid-range strategies, which open with green level and then start scoring. You start scoring and then you recover with green level. So it's often very difficult to actually res those three pieces of ice. So, like, two is fine. So that's why I've chosen to play a very menial, I guess, 16 ice, because you don't need much more. And if you did, it would detract a lot from the strategy. Yeah. Well, the advantage is that the cards in your deck being so aggressive and your identity helping you fill in a lot of gaps that your hand might leave open, they work really, really well together. So that's basically it.
Yeah, I just have one more thing to say on that note. Would you say that one of the main, maybe not as obvious, advantages of next design is that it increases the number of cards you see early, so you're more likely to see especially Mushin Notion, which is the perfect card to have on the first turn, but gets much worse as the game goes on?
Oh no, that's a big reason to play this deck. In my lists that I've toyed with, I started with 49 and realized it was the wrong way to go. This is the kind of deck you want to see those aggressive cards as often as possible. You want to see agendas as often as possible. So you need to keep that power density very high. And part of doing that is seeing as many cards as you can and just having the cream of the crop appear naturally. So yeah. That's another advantage over ETF. If you play the ETF, you would need to spend your first hand installing and then your second hand redrawing to find the actual aggressive pieces. Even if you play out one or two pieces of ice with next and not the whole three, you're ahead in both of those positions, both of which you have to have online to start being aggressive.
You and I have done quite a bit of testing with this list against my max deck, Shilzy, so I might already know the answer to this. I might already know the answer to this question, but how would you advise playing against your next build?
Against my next build? As like a max deck?
Oh, as anybody, really.
Oh, if you're an aggressive runner, just kill them. Just kill them. Just go into the server and kill them. Yeah.
Like against an aggressive runner, most of the time you're just going to lose if your opponent knows what you're trying to do.
Yeah, yeah. This deck, on the store champ day, I was XO against every deck that appeared mid-range or controlly, and I was OX against every aggressive deck. And the same has been true in my testing. If I'm up against a Riel deck with Refractor, I lose, straight up. Or if I'm up against a max deck that can have access to, you know, Data Sucker and Parasite, sometimes on turn one with a Dirty Laundry, or just good efficient breakers and access to them because of their natural draw ability. Or even just Andromeda decks that are willing to be more aggressive, play sometimes even 10 or 12 breakers between their passports or their... passport's not actually a good example because the Quandary is on the remote. But if it's an Andromeda deck that's happy to play two Corothas and a Femme and two Fairies and a Mimic and just enough programs that they can actually just play one on turn one and just run, you know, there's a good chance you'll lose to that. Because the thing is, this deck is so linear, that's exactly what it's asking of the runner. It's not asking them for any tricks to do with their economy, it's not asking them for any finicky play with upgrades or any shell games, except for maybe the one with a June bug. It's only asking for the bare fundamentals. Can you make this run successful? No? Cool, I win. Yes? Oh, you got me.
Obviously, I think this is the sort of root of a much larger discussion, one I hope we get to have in an upcoming episode. But are you happy with that sort of trade-off of bringing a deck which has, you know, an 80% win rate or a 90% win rate against, you know, 70% of the decks of the field and a 10% win rate against, you know, the other 20?
I did take two decks just like this to a store champ. So, yeah. In general, I like to have sometimes 6 or 8 decks built, and I really do just try and get a feel for the room on the day before I choose one. You know, maybe 50% of the time, I decide what I'm playing before I leave the house. But, like, usually I'll kind of decide on the day, and I'll have a few different deck lists printed up so I can hand one in at the appropriate time. Because I do like to get a feel for the room, and it is because of exactly what you're referencing there, Brian. It is because some matchups, some decks, are just so polarizing as they enter the field. So in the field that's with any deck that can actually just... for any deck that can separate the field in such a bipartite fashion, you know, half the field is on the left and half the field is on the right, you know, I want to put more of the field on the left, so I crush them all. But, you know, if it looks 50-50 or if it looks like there's a bit more on the right-hand side, I'll definitely shy away from this kind of deck and try and play something that is more in line with how I feel the room is going.
That's about all we have time tonight. If you want to get in contact with us, you can send us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. You can check us out on Twitter. Our handle is @winningagenda. Or check out our like page on Facebook, which is The Winning Agenda. And until next week, we look forward to hearing from you guys. It's been a pleasure as always. We'll see you soon.
Take it easy, guys. Good night.
Thanks for listening.